Tuesday, we had an introduction to conjugation, where we had done some review of some of the essentials of molecular orbital theory, talked about bonding and antibonding, built up to the point where we got to the allyl system. But I wanted to step back again and help give a little bit of context to what I was doing, because there's a type of problem that generally when I teach Chem 1A, I mention or try to at least sneak in, because it's one of the starting points for any discussion of quantum mechanics. It's this problem known as a particle in a box. Has anybody ever heard of the particle in a box problem? No? Okay. So, the particle in a box problem is the following. It's basically a thought problem of how do we describe electrons? How do we come up with these equations for wave functions? And this problem deals with a wave function that only exists in one dimension. So imagine that you've got a well that the electron is trapped in. And so either side of the well, those infinity signs, what that means is infinite potential energy. So in other words, to cross over those barriers, the electron would have to have an infinite amount of energy, which it doesn't, so it's trapped in between. Otherwise, in between the two, there's no potential. There's just whatever energy the electron happens to have. It turns out that in one dimension, the Schrodinger equation, which is the equation that we use to generate the equations for orbitals, for wave functions, the solutions to the Schrodinger equation in one dimension like this, one set of solutions are sine functions. But the sine functions have to be such that the value of the function is zero at one wall and also zero at the other. Because if you had a non-zero value, that means that the zero point would come outside the well here, which would imply the electron could somehow exist outside the well, which is not physically possible. So the wave function has to start and end at these what are called boundary conditions. Well, if you come up with a sine function that could possibly describe the motion, like if we wanted to show just half a sine wave, then we're going to have some kind of proportionality constant in front of the x-coordinate. That proportionality constant, though, there are multiple values that would work. Because, and I know this is scary, this is going back to algebra and functions, but if I were to double the coefficient, it would be like I shrink in half the function, correct? Which, if this sine function exactly spanned from one side of the well to the other and I shrink it in half, that means that there's another equation that will start and end still at the correct endpoints, but will have one more wiggle in it. And as you keep increasing that value of that coefficient, there's a whole set of wave functions that satisfy those conditions. And the first four look like this. I won't write them all on top of each other because it'd be illegible, but here's the first equation that would work, the second, the third, and the fourth. Which you might recognize as being exactly the same functions I got with the phone cord demonstration. Because that's the exact same type of situation. You have two endpoints that have to be fixed. In the phone cord case, there is no more cord once you run out of cord. So the ends of the cord are the ends of the system. And the only waves that can exist along it are ones, again, where the ends match those endpoints. And we generate these symmetric waves that, again, can be modeled by sine functions. So the reason for showing you this particle in the box problem is to show you it's an example of electrons having the same behavior as this phone cord thing that I demonstrated. Why does that matter for our discussion of conjugation? Because if you think of a conjugated system, which we're going to draw some pictures of in just a moment, you could view that as a series of p orbitals that are all in a line again being a one-dimensional object. And so the molecular orbitals, the bonding, non-bonding, or antibonding orbitals of a pi system could be modeled by waves just like this, where you have a function that spans across the whole molecule or has a node halfway through the molecule. So we're going to use these functions to guide us in shading in these molecular orbital bonding diagrams that we're going to draw. These diagrams that show how can we use p orbitals to come up with a shape that looks like the real bonding and antibonding and non-bonding orbitals that are present in one of these conjugated systems. Now let me add a little bit of detail to these small drawings here. These first four functions correspond to what would be the first four energy levels of that one-dimensional electron. Same N as N, L, M, L, and M sub S, the four quantum numbers. N is the principal quantum number, which tells you two things: the total energy of the system, effectively, and N minus one is the total number of nodes in that system. So notice that we have 0 nodes, 1 node, 2 nodes, 3 nodes. What happens when we go into a three-dimensional system, when we get to an atom, the nodes can be distributed in more than one way. They don't just exist along one axis. And that's how we end up with all the different shapes of atomic orbitals. That's a story for Chem 1A. Where I want to bring this to is to conjugation. Because we have seen ethene and the allyl system, but we need to generalize to be able, in theory, to handle a whole series of conjugated systems. And from left to right, these involve 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 p orbitals, which, due to symmetry, generate 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 molecular orbitals. And that's what we're going to do today, is figure out how to draw pictures for these different molecular orbitals. Before we get there, we got to talk about, well, what constitutes a conjugated system. Because look at these two example molecules. This is buta-1,3-diene. Diene. And this is buta-1,2-diene. The dot in the middle of that second structure is intentional. Not everyone uses it, but here's the issue. There is a carbon where that dot is located. The dot is helped to make sure that you realize that it's not someone that was writing a double bond but had some kind of pen issue. Or if you were really sloppy, you might accidentally connect the two double bonds. So to make sure that you know there really is a carbon there, even textbooks will often use that dot. Yes?
Why don't they just use defective?
Because what is the hybridization of that carbon? And if it's sp, it's linear. So you can't draw it bent because that would be misrepresenting the structure. Now, does conjugation occur in both of these molecules? Which, even before we draw that, I realize that it's been long enough since we've been through the whole long story about hyperconjugation versus conjugation that sections 1 and 2, at least, were a little bit fuzzy, collectively, about what the difference is between the two. Would you all like me to review what the difference between hyperconjugation and conjugation is? Can someone explain to me? I'm seeing some people say, oh, we're fine. I'm seeing people say, tell us. Can someone tell me what is the difference between hyperconjugation and conjugation? Okay. Right. So hyperconjugation is when you have an interaction that does not involve bonding, which notice I'm careful not to say non-bonding because we're going to find out that is bonding, just not. Well, that didn't make sense, did it?
Meaning the non-bonding orbital is a molecular orbital that happens to have zero energy relative to the atoms. But what I'm trying to say here is that there's just not any kind of orbital interaction like that that would be considered bonding, non-bonding, antibonding. It's just a little bit of donation of electron density to a neighboring orbital. And it usually happens from a bond into an orbital. That's different from conjugation, in which you have full overlap of all the orbitals involved, and the electrons can freely float throughout that whole system.
So let me write those definitions down, and then we'll come back to pictures of these two molecules. So hyperconjugation is the partial donation of electron density to a neighboring orbital through an interaction that does not involve a bond. And that's separate from conjugation, which is the full delocalization of electron density. Across multiple orbitals due to bonding overlaps. So now let's back up to these two example molecules. How can we demonstrate that conjugation should be occurring? How could we know experimentally that conjugation is occurring? I think I might have mentioned this in passing last quarter, but it's not something we focused on, so I don't expect that you recall. But maybe some of you remember from reading. What is there unusual about butadiene, 1,3-butadiene, that indicates to us that conjugation is occurring? What's that? That is something we're going to talk about in the future. And currently, because there's a single bond between there, the two double bonds can rotate independently. It's not impossible. And that will affect a reaction that we learn later on called the Diels-Alder reaction. But it's the single bond itself that turns out to be the key. Before I answer that question of how do we know, let me put in parentheses here, benzene. Because the same discussions we're having now about conjugation and both how do we represent it and how do we know it happens, the same story we're going to talk about with benzene. Because benzene has 6 carbon-carbon bonds that are all exactly equal to each other. But we write it with double bonds and single bonds. But there is no such thing as a double bond and a single bond in benzene. It's just the inadequacy of our writing system that leads us to do that. This is why, if you notice, I've carefully avoided, in most cases, putting benzene in any kind of reaction, in any kind of problem, where you might have alkene reagents being used. Which, let me just tell you, for most of the reactions that you learn, oxidation, hydroboration oxidation, oxymercuration demercuration, simple addition of halogens, none of those work with benzene, even though we write it with what looks like to be a double bond. And experimentally, as I just mentioned, all 6 bonds are equal in length, and they're somewhere between a single and a double bond in length. Now, which is generally the shorter bond, a single or a double bond, if we're comparing the same two atoms in those two different bonds? A double bond is shorter because you've got more electrons in between the two nuclei, which is going to help bring the two nuclei together. The single bond of butadiene is shorter than a regular single bond. So there's something bringing the two double bonds closer together, causing that single bond to contract. And that is due to conjugation. And let me go ahead and write that part of it down. I'll write that first, and then we'll see the picture. So due to conjugation, the carbon-carbon single bond in butadiene is shorter than a standard carbon-carbon single bond. The way we can observe whether there's conjugation or not, draw a SMOG diagram. So what is the hybridization of every one of the carbons in this molecule? SP2, because there's three sigma bonds on every one of those, and only sigma bonds or lone pairs count for hybridization. If we have four atoms that are all SP2 hybridized, then we're going to have four of these threefold flowers, you could say. Along with a raft of hydrogens. And then we've got our p orbitals, of course. And here we encounter exactly the same issue as in the allyl system. Which of the p orbitals do we overlap now? Yes. Which would help explain why that single bond is shorter than it should be, because all four of the p orbitals do overlap. Now again, use your imagination to think that that's a line of p orbitals, and now we have these electrons going into this linear system, which is kind of like the particle in the box. And once you fall off the end of the molecule, you're off the end of the molecule, so the electron isn't really going to do that on either end. So those are your boundaries. And so the wave function has to span those boundaries. Now before we get to drawing the pictures of the orbitals, though, let's look at this other system. And let me ask the same question, though. Do you think that that other system is also going to experience conjugation? The butadiene. I see you, a couple of people shaking your heads. Carolyn, can you come up with a guess why not?
It's like you got it in your head, but you can't figure out what it is. So. Yes. Think on it. Has anyone else got a suggestion, though? Yeah. That's right, because Kathleen a minute ago said that that central carbon is SP hybridized. If you have SP hybridization, that does mean you have two different P orbitals on that carbon. But the two P orbitals are crossed from each other. So one carbon on one side forms a double bond facing one way. The other carbon on the other side forms another double bond that's perpendicular to the first one. If they're perpendicular to each other, they have no interaction with each other, so there's no conjugation. This is what is known as a cumulated diene.
And let's draw a smog diagram for it. So we know that one carbon is sp hybridized. The carbons on either side of it are sp2 hybridized. And then we have the methyl group at the end, which is sp3 hybridized. And let me draw our key to the orbitals, which I think this might be the first drawing in an awful long time that has all types of hybridization that we get NoChem. So I'm going to draw one set of p orbitals non-shaded, and that's not meaning wave function, it's just to distinguish the two sets from each other. So one set of p orbitals forms its pi bond, then the other set of p orbitals is perpendicular. So since the two pi bonds are perpendicular to each other, there is no conjugation. Questions on that before we now do the molecular orbital description of 1,3-butadiene. Let me just see how low I am on time. Okay. So first, let me one last time remind us about those standing wave functions that I showed you in the context of the particle-the-box problem, which are the same functions that we saw in the phone cord, which underneath are the same things that happen in these pi systems. Before doing that, let me make this statement that I don't know how to do it conceptually to prove this. It's kind of a math and a symmetry thing. So you'll just at this point, unfortunately, have to accept it. The number of molecular orbitals, which means bonding, non-bonding, or antibonding orbitals. The number of molecular orbitals in a pi system. We can't really call it pi bond because it's more than two p orbitals involved. The number of MOs is always equal to the number of p orbitals in that system, or used to represent that system. So if we have the molecule 1,3-butadiene, we have four p orbitals, and it turns out a total of four electrons. So one thing that a lot of simple problems focus on in both conjugation and particularly in benzene or aromatic chemistry is how many pi electrons are there? Which, even if we get to the point where we say there's no such thing as a pi bond in some of these systems, at least when we write it on paper, that does represent a specific number of electrons, and it's valid to count it that way. So even though we might argue this is not a normal double bond of this molecule, we could still look at that, the way it's written, and say, oh, four electrons distributed in the pi system. We know it's four electrons because each bond has two electrons in it, and the sigma bonds are all perpendicular to the pi bonds, and so none of those electrons count. So what we're going to end up with then are four representations for each of the four molecular orbitals, each of which in turn has four p orbitals that comprise them. Now let me put on top of here the lowest energy standing wave, the next highest energy standing wave, next highest, and next highest. How did I know that I to draw it this way? Experience. How could I figure out how to draw it this way? Notice that this is one that spans, that this is half of each of these sides. They're equal. These is the wave split into thirds, and this the wave is split into quarters. This brings up an odd issue, though, because if you look at the p orbitals themselves, they're always set to be in thirds. So you're going to have, it's going to be interesting to figure out how to shade it. But this is what we could do. Overlap the wave, shade it based on that. What do we get? Well, so that you can still see those waves afterwards, let me make another set here that we'll actually color in. Yesterday, as I was drawing these smog diagrams, I made the glib comment to those sections that everything you ever needed to learn, you learned in kindergarten, because we were doing nothing but bubbling in bubbles with different colors. You just didn't realize in kindergarten that was preparation for hyperconjugation and conjugation, did you? So, one more time to remind ourselves, we have zero nodes, one node, two nodes, three nodes, which must be symmetric. And let's just put that in our final drawing. One, two, three. Every place there's a node, you flip sign of the wave function, which means you change which way you shade it. So the lowest energy system, again, think of that phone cord demonstration. The least amount of effort I had to put in is the one that generated this wave that spans all the way across, which to make something that looks like that, you would use p orbitals that all have the same sign of the wave function. For those of you still following me, and if you wanted to know the truer story, in real life, we don't add all four p orbitals evenly, because if you added this, then really what you'd end up with is a function that's effectively even all the way across, a line all the way across. In reality, you would take a small version of this p orbital, a large one of that one, a large one of that one, a small one of that one, to match the amplitude of this function that spans. I don't think they do anything like that in your text, but just for those few of you who do go on to PCAM or such, you're going to see the same diagram, but possibly with different size p orbitals. To come back to this version of reality, we go to the next orbital up. Since there's a node, two of the p orbitals that we use to represent the orbital are going to be one shading, the other two are going to be opposite. Now let's go back to both the first and the second molecular orbital and use our very fancy notation to show that in that lowest energy orbital, there's only favorable overlap that occurs, which means there's electrons between all the nuclei, which maximizes the interaction of plus and minus charge, which is why this is the lowest energy orbital. And in fact, because the favorable interactions, that's all you've got, that means it's going to be lower in energy than if the orbitals had never interacted in the first place. So I'm putting a line here with the zero marker on it, which represents non-bonding, which represents a situation in which the atoms combining don't do any better energetically than if they never combined in the first place. So because this is all favorable interactions, it's below that in energy. And so that is a bonding orbital. Everything below zero is bonding. Everything above zero is antibonding. Everything at zero is non-bonding, which we don't have in this case, so I'm not going to put that label on this time. The second orbital I just drew, you have, yes, a favorable interaction on each side of the node, but the node itself represents an unfavorable interaction. But overall, the interaction is favorable. And so we have another bonding orbital. A way that we've written this in the past. Oops. The favorable interactions outweigh the unfavorable. Again, why it makes it a bond. The third orbital, the middle two p orbitals would be shaded the same way, but opposite from either orbital on either side of it. So that means there are two unfavorable interactions versus the one favorable one. And so that's why we make that an antibonding orbital. And then finally, the highest energy one is where every other orbital is shaded oppositely, which means all that you have is unfavorable interactions. No electrons between any of the nuclei, which is totally unfavorable. That's why that's the highest energy orbital. But these are just the spaces. None of this stabilizes or destabilizes the molecule until you actually put electrons in it. Since we had counted earlier that there are four electrons, we're going to fill up these four orbitals, which work exactly in the same principles as atomic orbitals. Alfbau principle, which says the electrons try to attain as low energy as possible, so we start with the lowest energy orbital. Hund's rule, which says that if we have multiple degenerate orbitals, which means orbitals of all the same energy, you put one electron into each of them. Pauli exclusion principle, after you've filled up each of the orbitals once, you can put a second electron, but only if it has opposite spin. Do I expect that you remember those three rules? Yes. Do I expect that you remember them by name? Yes, because they still apply for molecular orbital systems. We filled up the lowest orbital, so again, back to the Aufbau principle. We have to go to the next highest energy orbital, which can accommodate two more electrons. We've now put the four electrons in, and that's it. So all electrons only went into bonding orbitals, so only favorable interactions occur. But two things I want to point out. The picture that we drew with two separate double bonds does not match the picture that we get from this lowest energy orbital. It would seem to more match the second one. But that's why this single bond doesn't act like a normal single bond, because we have more than just a separate interaction. We do have one interaction that crosses the whole molecule. The second thing is that there is this kind of quickie calculation that's done called bond order, which is the number of bonding electrons minus the number of antibonding electrons, that whole thing, divided by 2. Well, in this case, we only have the 4 bonding electrons. Divide that by 2, that gives us a total of 2 bonds. So across the whole system,
we effectively have two bonds, which that part matches the way that we draw the structure. Now, the same set of principles we can apply to 5, 6, any number of orbitals. But there's a generalization that I'm going to make when we come back on Tuesday once you've had a chance to read this. Because how many of you have actually read about conjugation? Wow. That's actually better than I expected because of the lab quiz. But that means that over the break, even though it's not for the test, realize you've got test 3 you've got to be worried about, even though you haven't gotten test 2 out of the way. So if you wait until after test 2 to start reading about conjugation, then you're going to have a big curve that you're going to have to climb up. So, the generalization, I'll say it out loud. If you have an even number of p orbitals, you'll have half orbitals be bonding, half be antibonding. Just like this system that we saw, just like in a standard individual pi bond. Two p orbitals turn into two molecular orbitals, one bonding, one antibonding. When you have an odd number of orbitals, like the allyl system, one orbital will always be non-bonding. And then of the remaining orbitals, half will be bonding, half will be antibonding. Two last comments I want to make for today. Because 12A, they learned about something in molecular orbital theory that I usually wait till to discuss until 12B, although having heard they discussed it, I might start doing it in 12A. Because you'd spend a lot of time in 1A talk about valence electrons. Now, it's always the valence electrons that matter. Why? They're the most energetic electrons. That out of any electrons in the system, they already got the energy ready to try to escape out from an atom. Well, we have the equivalent situation here. We've got two different orbitals, one that has higher energy electrons than the other. Well, those are going to be the electrons that react. Now, where do they go, though? Well, the first place they can, if you think about the reduction of an alkyne with sodium, if you think about the initiation of a Grignard preparation, in both of those cases, an electron goes into a bond. But it can't go into a bond. The bond's already got two electrons in its orbital. So where it goes into is an antibond. It goes into the lowest energy place it possibly can. So there are what are known as the highest occupied molecular orbital electrons, and there are what are called the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital electrons. And this is one way that interactions between two pi systems are, oh, wow. If this were 10 years ago, I would do some matrix move right now. Yes, I paused it for a minute there, accidentally. So, highest energy electrons go to the lowest energy orbital available. These kinds of interactions are the way we describe what are called paracyclic reactions, the Diels-Alder reactions, if you look at the syllabus, the stuff that we're going to learn at the end of the quarter. So we won't use this terminology quite yet, but this also shows up in spectroscopy, which is again why I'm going to mention it now. Because if you think about atomic spectra. Atomic spectra occur because you excite electrons and then they fall back down between different energy levels. Or spectroscopy is where you do the reverse. You add energy in and you cause electrons, or in the case of NMR, subtle reminder, we got NMR theory coming up again soon. In NMR, we add energy to flip the spin of a nucleus. But in other words, there's some exact packet of energy that corresponds to a photon that corresponds to a specific frequency of light that could, for example, bump one of these highest energy electrons up into the next orbital line. in conjugated systems, that generally happens somewhere in the UV spectrum. Or if you get molecules that are long enough, like carotene. Carotene is, what was it, 18? I forget how many double bonds in a row it is. But it's an enormous number of double bonds. It actually brings that energy gap into a range that, due to complementary colors, causes us to perceive orange. That's why carrots are orange. That's why, like me, when I was a kid, and my mom knew I liked carrots, and I liked them a little too much, my nose turned orange. It is a medical condition that can occur. So, but that, yes. I'm not recommending you try this. I think kids are more susceptible to it. And actually, if you way overdo it, carotene in too high quantities isn't that good for you. But that's that gap between the highest energy occupied orbital and the lowest energy unoccupied orbital that you would access in spectroscopy. I believe now, barely finished up almost in time. Any last questions before we break for the long weekend? Because remember, no class tomorrow, no lecture. And, well, you don't have class with me on Monday anyways, but there is no class Monday either. Can I move it up? Of course I can. So have a good break.